Welcome everyone to the first introductory lecture of the Personnel Economics 2 course, which is by mistake called Personnel Management. So
I just want to do a short introduction what we are doing here actually with the camera and so on. So maybe can I have?
Sure.
It's okay for me, it's just nice to you so everybody's hearing me. Good morning. We're from the lecture recording team here at the university. We are doing the recording of Nick's lecture here, so you can listen to him and then just to reimagine and repeat yourself for the personal management today. Is it right? Yeah. So it's like you have your own website where you can stream that. It's like the streaming.uni-constance.de. Other thing is that we are just recording Nick in front of you, so I have no problems to attend and to ask questions. It's like we are recording always what Nick always says and not yourself, so no personal problems at all. Otherwise, enjoy the lecture.
Right. I think it was very important. I think that this was a very important point that Roland has made. What is recorded is myself and the lecture slides. If there is a question, the student and the question put in the words, in the own words of the student, any questions, comments, remarks from the students are not recorded, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Not recorded. So if you feel like asking a question, don't feel intimidated. Don't think that it will be on record. If you have a question to ask, however stupid, it will not be kept for the posterity, right? Only the stupid answers I give will be kept on record. So feel free.
Exactly.
Right. Thanks. And thanks to the video recording team for their infallible support throughout my short and eventful career at the University of Constance. So now I see a number of familiar faces. So welcome back. It means you haven't had enough of my personnel economics stuff. And you're up for a new challenge, a little bit more interesting maths. Okay, the joke was flat and didn't go down very well. I teach the sequence of two personnel economics courses at the University of Constance. Personnel economics one, personnel. So one thing you need to learn as a result of this course is that it's not personal. I'm not talking about my private life during this course. It's about personnel. Personnel. Okay, Kira, personnel, not personal. So, now, as was the case with Personnel Economics 1, today the first lecture of the course is going to be the intro lecture where we will talk about the structure of the course, the topics that we will cover during the course, which will last for the entire duration of the summer semester. And the last lecture of the course will be the questions and answers lecture, or the revision lecture, more of which later on in this lecture and throughout the course. So those of you who had the divine pleasure of attending my Personnel Economics 1 course may have a vague recollection of the general unifying idea of the course. So the unifying idea, the sort of grand, big short idea of Personnel Economics 1 course was to study an employment relationship from its inception, from the beginning, until the end of this employment relationship. And therefore, the topics in the Personnel Economics 1 course were organized in sort of quasi-chronological, with an emphasis on the logical, order. From the beginning of the employment relationship, where people are hired and selected into an organization, through to the middle and the ripe age of the employment relationship, where people are motivated, where people are trained, when their performance is evaluated, and all sorts of financial motivators are provided to make sure that their performance continues to be adequate. And then we finished by talking about employee turnover and its causes and consequences for organizational performance. So this was the sequence of Personnel Economics 1 course. Now, Personnel Economics 2 course also has a big unifying idea to it. So when I was compiling the topics and lectures for this Personal Economics 2 course, the grand idea I had in mind was to focus more and more deeply on one stage of the employment relationship, namely the stage at which the employee is employed with the firm and they enter into an ongoing employment relationship, and as an integral part of this employment relationship is the question of how to motivate, how to provide motivation to employees during the employment relationship. So we're not going to be talking about hiring and selection, we're not going to be talking about employee turnover, we are going to be talking about the different ways of employee motivation in this course. So very narrow agenda, but a lot of stuff, a lot of stuff, a lot of interesting stuff. Why? I would argue, as a sort of professor of organizational economics here at the University of Constance, I would argue that employee motivation is the single most important element of the entire system of human resource management. So forget evaluation, forget the hiring, forget the motivation is the most important thing to do, right? So if you get the motivation right, much of everything else sort of ensues logically, okay? So how to motivate people well is much easier said than done, because people are very different. And if you want to motivate people, you have to provide motivations and stimuli that resonate with their reasons why they work for this particular organization. Right? You have to pull the right strings. And different people are like different musical instruments. There are very different things that get them ticking. For some people, it's money. Actually, let's face it, for most people, it's money. And I would say for the absolute majority of people, the predominant reason why they enter into employment relationship is money. And therefore, we talked a lot about pay for performance and financial aspects of employee motivation in the Personnel Economics 1 course. But that's not the entire thing. Motivation is not only about giving you more cash for better performance or giving you less cash for worse performance, right? It's an integral element of any motivation system, but that's not all about motivation. So in this course, we will be talking about not directly financial or even not monetary at all motivators. And as part of this course, we'll be talking about institutions and psychological environments that exist within the workplace that may be conducive or otherwise to making employees work hard, right? So you can have very lousy institutions where nobody cares, and then you can throw a lot of money in the wind by introducing all sorts of bonus schemes and not going to work, right? Or you can have a very productive, constructive, safe, and pleasant environment and working practical institutions that support the required work discipline and performance norms that exist within the organization and sanction those members of an organization who deviate from these norms. So much more about institutions, norms, and psychological climate later on in this course. Okay, now, how to motivate people is the big idea behind this course. Okay, forget everything else. Now, what is it? How can we motivate people? And here's a sort of list of strings, of levers that you can pull on various musical instruments, the pedals you can press. And it's not all, it's not the entire list, but these are going to be the topics that we will study in greater detail throughout the course. So we will begin with perhaps the most obvious, right? The most obvious way of motivating people, namely the exercise of authority. So how can you get an employee to work? You can tell him to work, okay? So how can you get an employee to come to work promptly and leave the work when the time is right? Well, you could record the time, you could issue lots of instructions and detailize a lot of sanctions that will follow if these rules are not abided. And, well, it's not that straightforward, actually, because there are clear advantages of authorities, but there are also costs of authority. People don't like extra control to be exercised over them. And for something that you don't like, you normally require what's known as compensating wage differentials. So you want sort of adequate compensation to keep you under participation constraint, so as still to remain within an organization. So there are costs and benefits of authority, and we will have two lectures on authority. The first lecture on authority will be about authority as part of a fundamental characteristic of employment relationship, and the second lecture about authority will be dedicated to the issue of delegating authority. You know, so there are very few, if any, organizations, firms, where only one person or one governing institution has the entire authority that exists within the organization. Authority is normally delegated down the hierarchy, down the organizational hierarchy. To what extent and what aspects of decision-making authority are delegated and to whom will be the matter of the second lecture on authority. Now, authority has limits. And the limits of authority, one of the obvious limits of authority is that you can only exercise authority when you can monitor people's compliance with your authority, right? It's no good telling people to come to work at 8 o'clock in the morning if you can't monitor whether they do or do not come to work at 8 o'clock in the morning. In one thing we learned from Personnel Economics 1 is that sometimes performance is, well, always performance can be monitored with considerable noise, right? So you can never get an absolutely precise idea of an employee performance. So your monitoring, your ability to monitor the worker's performance and therefore exercise authority is limited by the limited information that you have about the worker's performance. Now, one classical solution to the problem of limited information that employers have over the performance of their employees is to provide incentives. Incentives are great because they don't require authority. You don't have to push people into doing certain things. You don't have to order them to do certain things. If you give them a carrot, if you give them a bonus or an incentive or something that is valuable to them, not necessarily money, that will make their heart tick. They will deliver the verifiable performance result, and then the promise of incentives stipulated in the employment contract should come to fruition. We've spoken a lot about incentives in Personnel Economics 1. This stuff is sort of relevant here as well, and I assume that you are aware of the issues related to the provision and management of monetary incentives. But in this course, Personnel Economics 2 course, we will mention monetary incentives very briefly, that they basically exist and that's it. What we will concentrate, and we will have, I think, three lectures, if I remember right. I think we have three lectures on incentives. We will have a lecture on efficiency wage, career concerns, and a separate lecture on the definitions and relationship between extrinsic and intrinsic motivation. In which semester are you in? Sixth semester. Great. So the majority of you have studied microeconomics, introduction to organizational economics, some basic economics course. Some of you have even studied labor economics and microeconomics. So the majority of you should be aware of the notions of efficiency wages, right? Have you heard of the term efficiency wage? Efficiency wage is when you pay more than the market equilibrium wage. And the difference between the wage that you get in a particular firm and the wage that you could get on an open market is a sort of an element of monetary incentives for you to perform well. Because if you fail to perform well, you're fired and you will have to take the cut in your wage by finding an alternative employment on the labor market. That's how it works. But don't worry if you haven't come across the term efficiency wage in great length yet. We will have a separate lecture on efficiency wages. Now, another lecture we will have on the notion of career concerns. Have you heard of career concerns? Earlier? No? No career concerns? No career concerns experts? Don't worry, there'll be a very interesting lecture on career concerns as part of this course. Some very interesting mathematical apparatus will be introduced during this lecture, so I very much look forward to it. It's going to be great fun. The last lecture on the rubric of motivation as part of this course is the lecture on extrinsic versus intrinsic motivation. Sure, everybody's heard about what extrinsic and intrinsic motivations are, right? Extrinsic motivation is the relates to motivators that are extrinsic, that exist outside your person, right? Or the area of your interests. So it's the totally external reasons unrelated to what you feel, what you're interested in, what you like, for which you do certain actions, right? You're not interested in money as such. I hope not, right? You are interested in things you can buy for this money. So in that respect, monetary incentives is a clear example of extrinsic motivation. And so far, we have been talking about extrinsic motivators. But guess what? Guess what? There is also an element of intrinsic motivation. Believe it or not, some people actually like what they do at work, right? So and I know a few who actually like what they do. And the reasons that are not related to extrinsic motivators, which still motivate people to do the work that they do, is collectively referred to as intrinsic motivation, right? And there is a very interesting relationship between extrinsic and intrinsic motivators, more on which we will learn in the respective lecture. Now, let's move on. So I mentioned the climate and institutions as circumstances, as elements of the employment context that may be supportive or unsupportive of efficient level of effort within an organization. Now, let's talk about these. Let's mention these. We will have two lectures. One lecture we will have on teams, and the other lecture we'll have is on workforce diversity. Now, teams is an interesting arrangement. What is so interesting about teams? Well, first of all, teams is the predominant institution in the workplace, right? So most of the work, however calculated, either in economic value or in terms of statistical frequency, all sorts of surveys and databases exist that allow us, the ivory tower people, to learn something about the real world. All of these sources are telling us that most of the work today is carried out not individually but in teams, right? So teams is an integral element of the work organization. Now, what's so interesting about teams? Well, teams have advantages and disadvantages. They have to have advantages, otherwise people wouldn't do teamwork and all the work would be done individually. Now, one great advantage of teams is that teams allow you to pool different expertise and knowledge together, which is especially relevant nowadays that the technology is so sophisticated that soon human beings will be replaced by robots. That complicated technology is. And of course, there's no way one person can do all the aspects of a particular job equally excellently or at all, right? And yet, complicated products and services need to be delivered, and they are best delivered by teams of experts, each of whom is particularly good at a particular stage of production process. So teams are really instrumental in bringing together the different facets of human capital and expertise. Now, teams also have a disadvantage. And what is the biggest disadvantage of teams? What is the biggest problem with teams? Have you heard of teams in your courses? What's the biggest problem with teams? Free riding, exactly. That's right. You're hiding behind your teammates. You're free riding on them. You expect them to do the work, and you expect that credit for this work, either as recognition or as financial benefit, will be shared between you. Right? This is really a huge problem with teams. And we will, during the lecture on teams, we will look at how the problem of free riding can be managed in the workplace environment. What sort of incentives and what sort of institutions are helpful in either completely solving the problem of free riding in teams or at least in reducing the extent of the free riding problem. Now, one sort of obvious institution that needs to go, that an effective team requires, is the existence of some sort of institution that sanctions unproductive or free riding behavior. The good old boss, for instance, the team leader, the director, is one example, but it's not the only example that can be there. And we will study them in more details in the team's lecture. Now, another, speaking of the advantages of teams, the advantage of team is in bringing together the different knowledge and expertise. Bringing together diverse aspects of knowledge, expertise, insight, opinion, experience. So workforce diversity and, you know, cultivating and maintaining productive employment relationships in when the employees are different, diverse, working in the same team, is a very exciting area of research. This is more sort of HR-tinted area of research. There is a little bit of research on diversity in economics, but not so much yet. Yet I think it's a very interesting topic, and we will have a lecture on workforce diversity, how to manage workforce diversity to its fullest extent, because obviously workforce diversity may have negative consequences, may have its own costs, especially when people are so diverse that they can't understand each other, right? So yes, they have all sorts of knowledge, different knowledge, they bring it together, but when it comes to communicating this knowledge and making decisions based on this knowledge, conflict can appear. And the consequences of this conflict for performance may greatly offset the benefits of workforce diversity. Okay, now, carrying on with institutions and climate, social norms. You can reward good behavior by providing monetary incentives, either in direct way, see Personnel Economics 1, or indirect ways, see Personnel Economics 2. You can motivate productive behavior or sanction bad behavior by introducing by having authority. Someone, some sort of big brother who is watching you and can identify one particular person in a crowd of 50,000 or so. Read that news? A Chinese suspect was caught in a pop concert with 70,000 or so attendants. It's amazing, you know, they caught him on a little face on the video camera, and they said that's him. And it was very, very surprising. Great job. So there is Big Brother, and the Big Brother exercises authority. You can have a sort of smaller brother at the team level who is the boss of your team or other sanctioning institution to keep everybody on the straight and narrow. But you can also rely on a sort of intrinsic feeling of people about what's right and what's not. Even better news that you can actually cultivate and propagate the positive work performance norms. Now, the bad news is that you can also cultivate and propagate the bad work performance norms, right? So we will have two lectures on peer effects and one lecture of recognition. And during these little sequence of lectures, we will be talking about the economic and psychological mechanisms through which performance norms are propagated and through which individual performance norms affect collective performance norms and by as a result of it affect collective performance outcomes. And we will have one lecture on a cute little topic that I was particularly interested in a couple of years ago, namely employee recognition. So if you look me up, who I am and what I do, which I think you should, you will see that I've done some work on this topic, some work on that topic, but most of the media coverage of my work is on the little topic of recognition, which is very ironical in a sense because I haven't really published all that well on recognition. But, you know, the media thinks that this is really the most interesting part of my research. And we'll have a lecture on employee recognition as part of this course. Okay, now, last but not least, speaking of institutions and climate, One other way of motivating people, of providing motivation, that we will study in this course, is to be a good leader. So notice the difference. We did talk about the boss. We did talk about authority. And now we're talking about the leader. So the authority and leadership are two different things. A lot of people confuse them. A lot of people see no difference between them, right? In fact, very ironically, some of the most authoritarian political so-called leaders are called leaders. Look at this North Korean guy with a funny hairstyle. His official title is the Great Leader. The current president of Russia enjoyed a couple of years when he had his proxy governing the country. The current president of Russia used to enjoy the unofficial title of the national leader. Right? So a lot of authoritarian guys like to call themselves leader. Now, leader and the figure of authority are different things. What is so different between them? Well, we would have to invent the difference, right? We need one more lecture in this course. But, you know, more seriously, the figure of authority, the boss, the institution or a person that is sort of that is invested with authority has the legal procedural means to enforce authority, right? So if I have the authority to determine when you should come to your lecture, if I have the authority to determine under what circumstances you will pass my course, which authority I do have, I could reward you for fulfilling the performance norm on the course by giving you a certain grade, or I could punish you for failing to fulfill the performance norms on this course by giving you a fail. So I have the legal means to do it. Now, these legal means are not completely unchecked. You can look at your exam paper. You can actually argue. You could say, oh, but I don't think this is the fair grade, etc., etc. So there are procedures. But basically, I have the authority to, you know, determine your outcome, your performance outcome for this course. Okay, so that's the authority. Who is the leader? The leader is someone who can also influence the actions of others, but the leader does not have legal means of enforcing his or her authority. That's the big major difference. And this big major difference has a number of interesting implications. Well, if you can't, you can be leader and authority. You can be just authority but no leader, because you know this situation happens when people follow your orders, not because they believe what you say, but because they are afraid that otherwise you will sanction them. Or you can be a leader without an authority, without any authority. So people will follow your directions, people will follow your advice, not because they fear that they will be sanctioned for doing otherwise. They can't be sanctioned for doing otherwise because the leader does not have the legal means to do so. But basically, pure leadership is about providing information, providing signals to people which they find credible to a significant extent, credible enough, in other words, as to change their course of action without hearing or receiving these signals. Okay, so we will have a lecture on leadership that will bring these concepts together: leadership, how it's different from authority, how leaders can exercise their power, can leadership be efficient, can it lead to better performance outcomes, what are the moral hazard issues involved in the exercise of leadership function in organizations, will be the topics of this very interesting lecture on leadership. And the last lecture in the course, as I said, will be the questions and answers lecture. And here is the lecture topics, with the number of lectures and titles. We will have a total of 14 lectures in this course, including the introduction and revisions and questions and answers. But lectures, so This is how the course is organized. It's more or less the same as Personnel Economics 1. So those who had the extreme pleasure of attending my Personnel Economics lecture may have recall a very similar slide. So the point of communication, the nexus of communication between you and us, the course team, myself and Dr. Opieta, who will be teaching tutorials. Kira will be giving tutorials, more on these tutorials later on. So the nexus of contact between us and you is a thingy called Ilias. Have you heard of it? Freut mich. So people may not have heard about career concerns, never mind, we'll have a lecture on career concerns. We will not have a lecture on Ilias. So you have to understand what Ilias is. And one step towards understanding what Ilias is to go check it out and make sure that you register, make sure that you register for this course if you want to participate in this course. It's extremely important because all the course materials, and I will tell you which course materials will be there, all the course materials, all the tutorial materials, which are part of course materials, will be uploaded to Ilias. If you want to contact us, you could send us either a personal email, you know, check me out, and I think Kira's profile is also somewhere there, or you could send us an email. You could send us an email through Ilias. If you want to contact your course mates, right, you have to do it. You don't have to, but one convenient way to do it is by Ilias. If we want to contact you, for instance, by, you know, if God forbid we are ill or lectures need to be rescheduled or cancelled, we will convey this information via Ilias. So forget LSF, consider it as non-existent, right? We will be communicating things via Ilias about course dates, changes, etc., etc. Right. Now, what is the performance outcome that is particularly relevant for this course? Now, the only relevant performance outcome for this course is the final written exam, just like in Personnel Economics 1. There is no course paper. There is no homework. There is no other ways of getting a few extra points. Perhaps I should introduce some of these, for instance, you know, extrinsically incentivize active performance on the course, etc. But I just can't be bothered because I am very bad at administration. I'm a professor of organizational economics, but I'm very badly organized. So, final written exam will be the only key performance indicator, KPI, that is relevant to this course. It counts for 100% of the final grade. And I delegate the authority to assign the grade for this course to Dr. Opieta. So, now, course materials. I mentioned course materials. What are the course materials? So, the main source of knowledge for this course is the lecture and tutorial scripts. The thing you see here is the lecture script. I will be shortly, I think towards the end of this week, I will be uploading the complete lecture script of a few hundred pages to the Ilias, so you can easily download it and you would have the entire well-annotated, well-written set of slides with lots of information that is relevant to the course. So this is, if you like, the main course materials, the lecture script. Now, in addition to this, there is a so-called tutorial script. Tutorial script is very simply, is just a bunch of tutorial questions with solutions. This time, I've become older and kinder. So this time, with solutions that we did with Henrique Biel, who was my teaching assistant last time I gave this course. We did these questions, we solved these questions, and we went through these questions during the tutorials for Personnel Economics 2. For the benefit of you lot, I'm going to upload these slides to Ilias. I think they are an excellent source of getting an idea about what sort of questions you should expect on the exam, and They are, I think, a great source of preparation for the exam. Really, I think it's cool stuff. I will upload them. Now, there will be tutorials. Where do the tutorials come from? There will be a separately developed new content for the tutorials that you will be going through during tutorials with Dr. Opieta. And so the tutorials will proceed in a very standard way, like they always proceed in my courses. There are a list of questions, and these questions are solved or not solved during the tutorial. Now, there will be one little change. Please correct me if I'm wrong. If I'm wrong in the rendition of the thing that we agreed on. The one little change is as follows. In the past, I used to give lots of questions to students. And the idea was not to go through all the questions during the tutorials. I just threw in lots of questions, whatever odd question I had related to the topic, I just used to put it down. And what people ended up with is very often there was not enough time, there was not enough tutorial time to go through each and every question. Now, it was not the idea to go through each and every question during the tutorial. Never was it an idea. The idea was to go through a selected few questions during the tutorial, leaving the rest for your independent practice and exercise. Never mind, people didn't care. Many people thought that all of these questions should have been gone through during the tutorials. And that created a major piece of negative feedback about personal economics, the previous edition of Personal Economics 2, as well as the other courses that I'm teaching. So I've decided to be even more clear than I usually am, and to make tutorial sets that will include only the questions that you are expected to go through during these tutorials. As a result, of course, there will be fewer questions, because, you know, if you don't like a long list of questions, you will have a short list of questions. And the extra questions that you could go through and practice will be available in the tutorial script. Okay, so let's move on with the overview of the course materials. One minor but nevertheless important and exam relevant, ladies and gentlemen, Klausur relevant. Okay, part of the course materials are going to be the academic articles and sometimes even newspaper magazine clippings that I will be uploading to Ilias. So, newspaper articles as well as magazine and popular press articles are referred to in the course. Let me give you an example. For example, this, Simon, 1945, Administrative Behavior, right? So, when you see a name and a date, assume that it is exam relevant. Assume that you should check it out. Unless I explicitly say that this is not exam relevant. So I promise I will be nicer than this. I will tell you several times to make sure that this paper or this newspaper clipping is exam relevant. What it means, exam relevant? Everybody knows what exam relevant is, right? It means that questions based on this material can be put on the exam. Okay, now, so, and the last element of the course material is the past exam. So I will upload the exam that your colleagues had exactly, you know, almost 1 year ago in the summer 2017 for you to have even better and more precise idea about how the exam will look like. Okay? So if you go through the lecture scripts, if you go through the tutorial scripts, both with and without solutions, if you go through the past exam, and if everything is solved and worked out and you have no questions and everything's cool, don't worry about your exam. You'll do very well. If you don't go through the course materials, beware. Your hopes for passing this course or getting a good grade for this course may be undermined. Which brings me to the next part of this introductory lecture. And this part is about what it takes to do well in this Personnel Economics 2 course. Okay, a slide which the fans of my Personnel Economics 1 course may find painfully familiar. Okay, so the issues are more or less the same. What it takes to do well in this course. You have to be good at micro and econometrics at an undergraduate level. All right. So make sure you understand statistics, make sure you understand econometrics, make sure you understand microeconomics. Utility maximization, profit maximization, primal problem, dual problem, first order condition, Kuhn-Tucker, optimization, this kind of thing. Basically, you know, quite trivial undergraduate first or second level concepts. I'm sure you've gone through them, so it's just a matter of digging out your materials and you know, making sure that you have more than passing recollection of these terms. Also, it's very useful, although not completely essential, but it's very useful to be good at maths. Maths is the language of economics, right? Yes, it is the language of economics. So no blah blah. Optimization problem, first order condition, comparative statics on the first order condition, conclusion. This is how economics works, right? At least the sort of economics that we teach here at universities. So if you're not very good at maths, time to improve it. Time to improve it. So make sure that you are familiar and can work with derivatives, integrals, and optimization problems. All right? So Personnel Economics 1, Personnel Economics 1, I was quite pleased with the distribution of the exam results for Personnel Economics 1. And if you sit here and if you did well on Personnel Economics 1, sounds like a good signal. Sounds like you have the knack for taking Professor Zubanov's courses. Now, so if you didn't do very well on Personnel Economics 1, time to improve yourself. So it's very useful to download the course materials for Personnel Economics 1. They're available on Ilias. It's not compulsory, okay? Not compulsory. You don't even have to physically be here because lectures are video recorded. But having said that, it's very useful. Believe me, I've been a student myself some time ago. It's very useful to actually come to the lectures and tutorials and participate in lectures and tutorials. What do I mean by participation? Very precisely, asking questions, making comments. If you have something that you don't completely understand or if you've lost the logic somewhere at some point, ask a question. There can be stupid questions. There can be irrelevant questions. But I will not say that this question is stupid or irrelevant, however stupid or irrelevant it might be. And your own questions are not going to be recorded. So if you have questions, please take the opportunity of seeing me during the lectures or seeing Dr. Rupieta during tutorials and ask your questions. All right? It's very important. Because if you've lost it and you don't bother to ask questions, to try and, you know, try and reestablish your connection with the course, your chances of passing the exam well are reduced. So it's very important to participate in lectures and tutorials. An open and inquiring mind and a genuine interest in the issues related to personnel management and human resource management. The two are close synonyms, so, right. Well, it's more sort of on the philosophical side of things, right? So I know that to some of you, attending this particular course is a Pflicht. Am I right? But, you know, if it's not compulsory for you, if you've chosen to do it, make sure you're interested in it. Because you're not interested in it, it's the door is there, right? So I really want interested, motivated, high-performing, inquiring, open-minded students as part of this course. I'm not really terribly worried about whether I will have 50 students or 40 students or 150 students, right? So I will become to get worried if I have 5 or 6 students. Then it's the time to sort of rethink my ways. But as long as it's more than that, so make sure you enjoy the course. If you don't enjoy the course, drop it. But if you do enjoy the course, and if you can help attending it, if you follow the course, I see no reason for you not to enjoy the course, not to learn a lot, and not to pass the exam well. Okay, speaking of the exam, exam is the only way that your knowledge is controlled and rewarded on this course. It's a standard 90-minute exam, written exam, which will, I think you've taken tons of exams so far, right? What tips can I give for doing well on the exam? Okay, my exams all look the same organizationally, right? So it's a 90-minute exam. The maximum number of points that you can get is 90. So 1 point per minute. The tip, the first tip is, if you have a question that is worth 10 points, it gives you an idea about your optimal allocation of time for the question, right? So if you are like well over 10 minutes dealing with this question, you're doing something wrong. Stop it and do something that's more profitable. Because the marginal benefit of you sticking to this question for much longer than what it's worth is very quickly going to be very small, if not negative, right? So you should spend your time in proportion to the number of points that a question gives. Okay, second tip, how to do well on the exam. Maximize the amount of information that you maximize the amount of information that you are conveying. Some naive students think that if they write pages upon pages upon pages of trivial how do you do stuff in hardly legible writing, they think that there's a correlation between the number of words and the number of points. There is a correlation between the number of words and the number of points. But this correlation is just a statistical illusion, because the effect that causes the number of points is not the number of pages, it's the amount of information that you are delivering, right? So don't use uninformative blubber. I hate it. Everybody knows that employee motivation is among the most important managerial tasks. Everybody knows that in the modern world full of technology and competition, managing human resources is of utmost strategic importance, and crap like this, which makes a lot of sense, but it's not related to the question that you have to answer. Do you understand? Right? So it takes time writing this blubber, but it's not going to add you any points. Now, so there can be different types of questions on the exam. And roughly we're talking about two classes of questions: verbal and numerical. So verbal questions are most of the times asking you to give a definition of a certain concept that you learned in the course. You just have to give a definition of that concept and get your points. The number of points will be determined by how precisely you define the concept that you've been asked to define. Sometimes the questions are asking for your opinion. There are a few questions like this, but they pop up from time to time in my exam papers, right? So opinion, right? It's what you think. Now, if you just write any old nonsense and claim, oh, it's my opinion, and because I wrote 10 pages of it, I should get the full point for it, think again. Every opinion, in the world of serious science, needs to be justified by facts and logic, right? So you may have very exotic opinions, you may have opinions that do not agree with the course material. I would be very interested to hear your opinions that do not agree with the course material, by the way. Seriously, come check me out. I sit in office F249. But you always have to justify your opinion. Make sure you justify your opinion with facts, theories, and logic. Now, turning to the numerical class of questions, they're very simple, very simple. You have a mathematical problem which you have to solve. And this mathematical problem has a specific solution. which needs to be clearly established as part of solving this question, right? So therefore, make sure you derive things explicitly, okay? So if I don't see, or Kira, if we don't see the results of your derivation, if we don't see the results of your work, if we see just title of the question and then your numerical answer or whatever, you are not, to put it mildly, you're not going to get the full points. We need to see your solutions. We need to see the proof that you haven't guessed it, or you haven't copied it from a colleague, or you haven't, you know, whatever, guessed it, yeah, that you actually arrived to the answer of this numerical question through techniques and principles of mathematics and economics that we learn in this course. The last tip for the exam, the last tip for the exam is, ladies and gentlemen, please, I implore you, even though I'm not the one who grades the exam, but, you know, on behalf of the University of Constance, if you like, please write in a legible and understandable way. It's very important. All right? So, says someone whose handwriting has basically degenerated into totally illegible because I hardly ever write these days. I type. Okay? So, I understand that some of you may have very bad handwriting. If you have bad handwriting, use block letters. Use block letters. Make sure, by whatever means possible, make sure that Kira and I can actually read what you've written. Because if we can't read what you've written, you're not going to get credits. And then, of course, we can say, oh, look, you didn't give me a credit because we say, oh, we couldn't read what you've written. Oh, but isn't it clear? Here's what I've written. It's a lengthy procedure. It wastes everybody's time. The outcome of this procedure is uncertain. So to prevent these issues from happening, please write legibly so that we have a clean, clear, and unambiguous record of what you've written as the basis of for assessing your work, or, as the case may be sometimes, discussing the result of your exam afterwards. As you sure have seen on LSF, the rhythm of the course is bi-weekly. Remember? Have you seen this in LSF? Right? So this is an exception. You know, this lecture is just one lecture. Normally, there will be two lectures in a row, once every 2 weeks. Right. Then it's next Monday. Yeah. So the details, the dates on LSF are correct. We'll copy them. So we have bi-weekly rhythm of the course, and once every fortnight we're going to have two lectures in a row. Let's see how it goes. And if it doesn't go very well, let me know, and I'll see what we can do. I can't promise that we will get back to the usual rhythm, like one lecture every week. I can't promise this to you, but if you're really uncomfortable with this rhythm of lectures, let me know and we will see what we can do. Well, good. Then thanks for coming. I'll see you whenever.